Hello. This month, Nguyen and I ask three questions. Why did Churchill appease the Japanese and close the Burma Road? Who is the greatest woman in American history? And why did the Soviet Union sign a 1975 human rights agreement which would bring about the fall of communism in Europe? And we meet the actor, goalkeeper, anti-Nazi resistance fighter and anti-communist campaigner who was widely seen as an agent from God.
History of the month, Paul. Where should we start?
Well, let's start with our World War II segment, and we'll focus on China in July 1940. At this time, China was really being thumped by Japanese bombing raids, and the country was being choked by the closure of supply routes into China one by one, climaxing with the Burma Road. So why did Britain take Japan's side and close the Burma Road? Well, Japan had enforced a naval blockade on China since 1937 to stop supplies coming in that way. There was another supply route via Hong Kong, a land route via Hong Kong, which was lost when the Japanese occupied Guangdong at the beginning of the end of 1938. And then the second of three main land supply routes was cut off in June 1940 under Japanese pressure when the French were defeated by the Nazis in Europe. French Indochina closed off, gave in to Japanese pressure and let Japanese troops come in and close off supplies to free China. So that just left this third and final route, the Burma Road, and it really could determine sort of life or death. The Chinese were in a really precarious position there. But the roads had been built by the British through Burma. It was gravelled, graded and bridged, and it ran into China to Kunming. It opened in late 1938, and the British were actively helping the Chinese by using this supply route in their fight against Japan. Of course, Britain's officially neutral in this conflict. We're talking at a time when it's the Sino-Japanese War. It's not part of the bigger World War II yet. And Britain is looking to not provoke the Japanese into attacking British colonies in Asia. So, yeah, in July 1940, Britain's as yet undefeated by Germany, but is expected to fall soon. The Battle of Britain's just beginning. And so Britain was expected to fall, and the UK military presence in Asia had already been dramatically reduced. And, of course, they're supplying nationalist China. And, Winston Churchill, of all people, caved into Japanese pressures. On 18th of July 1940, he closed the 117-mile-long Burma sector of the route into China. And so this man, known for criticising the appeasement of Germany, now readily appeased Japan, and China's supply route was cut off at a time when the Japanese attacks were accelerating. Free China's supply routes, as I said, had been cut off elsewhere, and the Japanese advance through Hubei province was continuing. And Chongqing, the capital, of course, came within striking distance of a new weapon, Japan's Mitsubishi Zero fighter.
I was going to say, I had no idea Britain and Japan were, well, not friendly, but I had no idea that Britain would choose Japan over China.
Yeah, it does feel like that. They were at least nominally on the same side in the First World War, Japan and Britain. I suppose the British line would be, it was practicalities, it was trying to not provoke Japan. Japan had been asking for the road to be closed for 2 years, and Britain had kind of clung on. But as the rest of Europe was defeated by the Nazis, and Britain felt even in more alone, including in Asia. So those other European empires were, you know, had been defeated.
Britain and America were sort of on the same side as well. And this was before relationship between America and Japan deteriorated.
It was a turning point, perhaps, or all round, because also at this time, Churchill withdrew the last of Britain's troops from Shanghai, which was a very international city, of course, at this time. And he did that because the Japanese asked him to. So that allowed the Japanese control of the financial heart of Shanghai. And at this point, this is indicative of the Americans looking to kind of fill the void that's left as the kind of European countries step back from Asia. And America's concerned that Japan's going to step into all these gaps. So America said that they were planning to send in the US Marines to Shanghai to replace the British patrols. But at that point, the Japanese threatened to send more troops to stop the Americans. And so even America then backed down at that point. and you know, Japan extended its control. Yeah, it is an interesting dynamic, and within a few months, things would be very different, that relationship between Britain and Japan. But in the meantime, of course, China's relationship with Britain is changed, perhaps forever, arguably forever, because during that summer of 1940, Britain finally began to show China at least some respect, perhaps really for the first time in history. With Britain under siege at home and with Japan now threatening Britain's empire in Asia, it was Britain's turn to ask China for help and to ask Chiang Kai-shek to cooperate over defending Hong Kong, as well as Burma, Malaya and other countries, territories nearby. So this was really a time when that relationship changed, and as you say, as a time when the USA, they really did pivot into Asia, to use Obama's term. This was really it. This was when they moved almost their entire fleet, or certainly the bulk of it, to Pearl Harbor, to send a message that they've got their eye on what's happening. Americans' natural concerns were more the Philippines and Indonesia, but still it was Japan, of course, they were concerned about. And Britain, of course, had shown its weakness as an ailing power, certainly by comparison. And Chiang Kai-shek was increasingly looking to America for support. In fact, his brother-in-law, T.V. Song, visited Washington in July 1940. So at the same time, Life magazine described it like this. A Chinaman comes flying into Washington. He takes a room in a hotel. He talks to a couple of people. He tells a story. He sticks to it. And the first thing you know, that Chinaman walks off with $100 million US in his pocket. 100 million, just think of it, says Life magazine. So, of course, that would go to China's war effort. And we see, just by way of sort of a postscript on this story, October 1940 is when Churchill backtracks and reopens the Burma Road. I guess he thinks better of it. By then, he's not worried about provoking the Japanese. He's lost any respect or perhaps fear that he had. And when the Burma Road reopened, waiting to transport the cargo from Burma into China were 2,000 American trucks, which had been smuggled by ship into Burma thanks to funds secured by T.V. Sung's visit to the US. So you've got these Burmese labourers hoisting barrels of American gasoline and kerosene, rifles, ammunition, bales of cotton, even airplane wings were lifted onto American trucks in Burma. And Time magazine reported that as the trucks pulled away and headed towards China, rumbled up the Burma Road, thousands of Burmese labourers clapped and cheered, and China then knew as well, of course, was buoyed by this. China knew that their fight was back on.
Right, welcome back to the 1-2-3 show with me, Noreen Mair, and Paul Letters, author and historian. You also have a website as well, Paul. For people who want to go to his website, do go to paulletters.com. Lots of great information there. A lot about his book, a bestseller book as well, and also a segment on This Month in History that he's doing right now live on the airwaves. At the beginning of the program, Paul, you asked the question that the US, they are asking for suggestions for a female.
The U.S. Treasury is currently considering which leading American female from history to honor by picturing them on the $10 bill. And so, yeah, we're asking for you to let us know who you think the greatest American woman in history is.
Yeah, and this is the first the first ever woman to appear on a dollar bill.
Exactly. Yeah, and we've had on Facebook and on social media, we've had some suggestions. Yeah, Jan from Holland, Pamela Anderson. Karen from HKU, Grace Kelly or Marilyn Monroe. There seems to be a theme emerging there. But I could be wrong, but I doubt the US Treasury is going to sort of be swayed by the beauty and blondness, if there's such a word, to put on the $10 bill.
I was thinking Ellen DeGeneres would be very... I love Ellen.
Yeah. I don't know how current they'd want to be.
They want somebody in history.
Yeah.
Well, it's difficult because up until, I don't know, 50 years ago, women weren't allowed to go to school. Well, okay. 100 years ago,
yeah, of course, so it's much harder for women to sort of to get to the top. But to be fair to Karen, who I mentioned a minute ago from Hong Kong U, she also suggested Eleanor Roosevelt, which for me would be a definite kind of claim there. She was, of course, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's, President Roosevelt's wife, but she was really his kind of eyes and ears. She was out there for him, visiting the poor. President Roosevelt had polio, and it was Eleanor who was doing more of the visiting coal mines and migrant camps and so on, and making sure that the president's aid projects got to where it was needed most, because this is in the 1930s, Great Depression time. And she championed civil rights for African Americans, equality for women, and after her husband died, she carried on his commitment to the new United Nations and helped to write the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Wow. So, great suggestion, Karen. Yeah. Wow. I was going to suggest Pocahontas. Now that just...
Yeah, somebody else did do that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah. Wait, she did exist.
She did exist, yeah.
Okay,
not, just
not just
a Disney.
Disney.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
What's the next topic?
Yeah, our final kind of main topic. It's 40 years this month since the Helsinki Conference, which I'm thinking now the listeners thinking, what's that? It's little known and it should be better known, which is why I want to bring it up today. July 1975. In previous years, so this is Cold War Europe's our setting, and we're really, in my opinion, looking at the beginning of the end of the Cold War as early as 1975. But there'd been a series of uprisings in Eastern Europe in communist states in the years before this. For example, the 1968 Prague Spring. And the Soviet leader of the time, Leonid Brezhnev, he desperately wanted these uprisings to stop. He saw these rebellions as being orchestrated by the West. I don't know if that rings any bells in modern politics.
No.
And Brezhnev was desperate for the West to stop trying to change the Eastern European states. He was paranoid that the West were not going to stop until they'd made Eastern European states into capitalist democracies. So he just wanted the West to accept sort of the boundaries as they were. And so a public declaration to that effect, public signed agreement, would discourage any potential future sort of Prague Springs. In return for the US and Western Europe signing such a declaration, promising not to interfere in communist Europe, in Helsinki in July 1975, Brezhnev agreed to allow states in Eastern Europe to recognise human rights as set out in the UN Charter, as written in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that we mentioned earlier that Eleanor Roosevelt helped put together. So you've got this signature by the leader of the Soviet Union, as well as from the different governments of the communist states, promising to adhere to human rights. And at the time, Brezhnev must have thought this was, you know, he could just write anything on a bit of paper and he'd gain much more out of it because he couldn't be forced to do anything and he would gain the non-interference of the West in Eastern Europe, or so he hoped. But the effects of that agreement were certainly unpredictable. A Czech rock group, a punk group really, called the Plastic People of the Universe. A great name. You can YouTube this and listen.
What's it
in.
Called again?
The Plastic People of the Universe.
Wow.
I would say musically, in my opinion, it's an acquired taste, but I'm not a music expert.
I'm just typing the Plastic People of the Universe. Brilliant. A Czech rock band from Prague.
And they formed in 1968 after the Prague Spring, and their lyrics were sort of pro-freedom, and they were performing in secret in Czechoslovakia, as it was then, dodging the police as much as possible. But the police caught up with them in 1976 and arrested them just months after the Helsinki Agreement of July 1975. And their trial came round in January 1977. And this provoked intellectuals to draw up what they called Charter 77. And Charter 77 called for freedom in general, including for the Plastic People of the Universe, but also called on the authorities to respect human rights. And it specifically said the human rights that you've signed up for in the Helsinki Agreement in July 1975. We want to hold you to that. So these guys who signed Charter 77 were known as the Chartists, echoing the Chartists from 19th century Britain. But then they themselves, the Chartists, were arrested, one of whom was playwright and and rock music lover Vaclav Havel, who went on, he died a few years ago, but he went on to be the Czech Republic's first president at the end of the 90s, early noughties. Of course, that's way in the future from our looking at the 1970s. During Vaclav Havel's years in prison in the 70s and 80s, he became the movement's leading writer, and he was writing plays and books from prison, an article, of course, all of its similar themes, pro-freedom. And through the power of the pen, he really was the movement's leading voice. And he didn't call for armed resistance, and you can think of echoes of other freedom fighters of the 20th century here. Armed resistance would have been bloody and pointless. He called for subtle resistance. He called for individual behaviour that would set individuals apart from the state. So people who failed to do that, people who just conformed, were confirming the system, wrote Havel. People who conformed confirm the system, fulfil the system, make the system, are the system. So he said individuals should be true to what they believe is right. So, for example, the state, the communist authorities, regulated beer production so that it would all taste pretty much the same and be cheap to make and so on. Havel suggested a brewer should make beer of better quality than the state actually regulated for. Kind of a novel way of running against the grain. And he said it just takes one person to make a mockery of the rules of the game. And then, like the emperor's new clothes, it just takes one shout of the emperor's naked to sort of expose the whole game as false and begin to just crumble the system. And so Havel really gave voice to the discontent building in Eastern Europe, and he drew upon that Helsinki Agreement and the fact that the Eastern European states had signed up to it. So he's given these visions of a better society. And at this time, this is the late 70s now, you might say, and this is to take the analysis of the leading American Cold War writer, John Lewis Gaddis, who says, you might say that now, at this point, God intervened, much to the alarm of the Kremlin. This will give us a minute on this, and I think it'll make sense. A guy called Karol Wojtyla, Polish guy, was perhaps, arguably, an agent from God. And he would lead Eastern Europe away from communism. Certainly millions of people believed he was an agent from God. Wojtyla was an accomplished actor, a poet, a playwright, just like Vaclav Havel. He was also an athlete. He'd been a professional goalkeeper. And during World War II, he'd been a member of the Polish resistance against the Nazis. And this was an all-round amazing guy. He became a priest in Poland in 1946, Archbishop of Krakow in 1964, Cardinal of Poland in 1967, and then, of course, if you've not seen it coming, Pope John Paul II was who he became in 1978.
Oh!
Yeah, the first non-Italian pope in almost 500 years, the first Slavic or East European pope ever.
Yeah.
And, of course, Eastern Europe's under communist rule, and we know John Paul was a guy who would say what he thought, and he certainly did. The Soviet leader at the time, a guy called Andropov, he asked his chief official in Warsaw, how could you possibly allow the election of a citizen of a socialist country as Pope? I'm not sure how that was answered, but just imagine the pride of the Polish people and other East European Slavic people. It seemed to them, to millions of Catholics there, that God had taken sides in Eastern Europe's battle with communism. And just before John Paul's first visit to Poland as Pope in June 1979, the Communist Party was warning that the Pope's our enemy, he's dangerous, he's a defender of human rights. He said, our activities designed to atheise the youth must intensely develop, all means are allowed. They were really worried about this guy. And Brezhnev told the Polish party leader not to let the Pope in the country. This is quite at the last minute before the visit in the summer of 1979. But the reply was, well, we can hardly turn away the first Polish Pope. Brezhnev said, if you let him in, it will only cause trouble.
Wow.
He was right, as it turned out. When John Paul II kissed the ground after he arrived in Warsaw Airport in the summer of 1979, he began the process whereby communism in Poland would end, and then, of course, communism across Europe. Hundreds of thousands of people met him at the airport, shouting, chanting, we want God, we want God. And then when he visited Krakow, 3 million people greeted him. Decades earlier, Stalin had once said, the Pope, how many divisions has he got? And John Paul II, on this visit to Poland in the summer of 1979, provided the answer to that. And he set the example. He rattled the authorities. He made speeches criticising communism and speaking for freedom. He went to meet freedom fighters. He inspired people like Lech Walesa, the young electrician who formed Solidarity, the first independent trade union ever seen in any communist country. And the cracks were showing here on communism as the world knew it. And of course, all this is at a time when things were rapidly changing in China as well, where Deng Xiaoping was telling the world to get rich quick.
That's why at the beginning of the intro you said how a punk rock group and then a writer and God brought down communist Eastern Europe.
Yeah, those factors and those actors certainly worked together to begin to break it down. Of course, a lot more happens later, and I hope we'll get to that in one show.
Yes. Okay, finally, we have a little bit of a woman, actually. You suggested another woman on the bill.
Yes, actually, someone suggested Amelia Earhart as a great American woman from history to be on the new $10 bill, when the US Treasury makes their decision to put their first female on a banknote in America, which they should be making their decision sometime in the next few months. It was on July 2nd, 1937, that her light aircraft went missing over the Pacific. She had been the first female to fly solo across the Atlantic. And her aircraft's never been found, so she continues to sort of fascinate and inspire people today. There's been a search party out in the South Pacific just these last 2 weeks looking to solve the mystery. Impossible that they solve this mystery, the search for Amelia Earhart's aircraft, before MH370 is found. Yeah, they're currently looking at sonar images of a depth of about 600 feet that they believe was part of the remains of her aircraft. So they're analysing that data just right now. The main theory is that that she would have run out of fuel and ditched in the middle of the ocean. But there is another theory, and one of her cousins, actually a fourth cousin, supports this theory, and certain historians and divers are. Sorry, and excavators are kind of on board with it as well. And the theory claims that two pieces of bent and corroded metal that were found in the Marshall Islands are evidence that Amelia Earhart crash landed there in 1937. And they argue that she had a navigator with her, Fred Noonan, that they were taken prisoner by the Japanese. This was before World War II in general, but of course the Japanese militarization was. And spread into China and beyond was already happening, and that they were taken prisoner and held through World War II and died in captivity during World War II.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's... I don't know. I mean, it's an exciting theory, but whether that's more likely than the running out of fuel and ditching in the ocean, I'm not so sure.
I was reading a little bit about Amelia Earhart as well, and there were talks to say that searching for her would prove to be very expensive, so ultimately they just abandoned the search.
Until very recently, that's right.
Yeah, it was very costly. Paul, as usual, always a pleasure to have you on the program. I always learn so much from you.
If we've got 5 seconds, I should also say, actually, because she's been mentioned so many times, and I meant to say earlier, Rosa Parks has been put forward as a fantastic candidate, this African-American civil rights activist, to go on the $10 bill. And, of course, her refusal to give up her seat to a white passenger on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama, then became a legal case, and Martin Luther King got on board as a local minister became a huge news. And she was an activist already and remain one throughout her life.
Thank you so much, Paul, and we'll see you in a month's time.
Thank you.